Okay, you have reached a WGXC Accra 90.7 radio for open ears. This is the latest installment of my show called Reading is Functamental. My name is Sal Cataldi. It is a monthly show where we talk to people who write great books about music. I'm a music writer for places like the New York Times and Pop Matters, a local musician with bands like Spaghetti Eastern Music and Space Heater and Guitars of Go-Go. But today we're talking about Chris Wood, the fantastic sax player for the band Traffic, a really star-crossed figure in the history of rock music. But we have here Dan Ropeck, who has written a fantastic book about Chris, his adventures in Traffic, before Traffic. And he was an actually very interesting cat who was kind of in touch with spiritual things and all sorts of mystic stuff, which he did bring to the Traffic blend. And this is a great show. It's a particularly good interview. So why don't you just sit back and listen to it at WGXC Accra. Here we go with Dan Ropeck, all about the fantastic Chris Wood. Okay, we are here with Dan Ropeck, who has written a fascinating, wonderful, and very in-depth book about an almost forgotten man in some ways in terms of the history of rock and classic rock. It's Chris Wood, the reed player, and I guess to some degree uncredited songwriter from a lot of the material from the band Traffic. Welcome, Dan.
Glad to be here, Sal. Thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
So Traffic was one of my favorite bands growing up. I had just recently spoke to Dave Mason about his memoir. And I had mentioned that when I was in 1971, when I was in art class, I made a bas relief of the Traffic symbol. So that's how far back my wow. life goes. But well, let's start with your interest and how what you do and how you got particularly interested in this subject, Chris, and the book.
Yeah, it went back a ways. I mean, I was kind of like you, not maybe as intense as you. I never drew the Traffic symbol when I was in art class or anything like that. But you know, I remember hearing "Dear Mr. Fantasy" probably when I was in seventh grade or something like that. And it still to me is kind of like a magic song, you know, it just kind of has a vibe. But I wasn't a huge fan until I got older, because Traffic was, I liked a lot of rock and roll and stuff like the Stones and the Stooges and stuff like that coming from Detroit. I was born, near Detroit, Michigan. So we heard a lot of everything, and Traffic was more subtle. So I got into it later, almost in my adulthood, where I was really like going, wow, this is special. You know, this is not the regular fare that I was used to. So anyways, it kind of soaked in over time. And then the way this kind of got started was, you know, Chris was one of those guys that when the internet started kind of get going, you couldn't find out anything about him. You know, there was a picture of him. There was just a little blurb. It said a couple words. And I'm like, but this guy's really interesting, you know? And then around, it was like the 96 or something, there was, remember those listserv things where you could join and talk about different subjects and stuff. So that was primitive internet days. And there was one for Steve Winwood. And I was a Winwood fan, but you know, more of a Traffic fan, but all these people suddenly were in my orbit that I could talk to.
Right.
And there was one woman in particular from Italy. Her name was Elena Iglio, and she's in the book a little bit. But she was a big Chris Wood fan, and she sent me a cassette of some of Chris's unreleased work. Right. And that was crazy because, you know, it wasn't bootlegged. It wasn't anything. It was just not out there at all. And when I heard that, I go, wow, this guy was, he had something else going on just besides Traffic. And so I kind of fell into it from there. Mm-hmm. And Elena, I call her Ellie. She's such a great woman because she was so generous. And she was friends with Chris's sister.
Right.
And so that was kind of like a way in to kind of like get a direct line in towards Chris. And then the more interested I got and the more I wanted to know, you know, it sort of grew from there, I guess, is basically what I'm saying. And with Chris's sister Stephanie's help, she basically said, you know what, do this thing if you want to. And then I started getting names and contacts, and then one person would lead to another and one would lead to another. And I'll just kind of wrap up this part of it by saying, you know, when I first started this, I still wasn't sure that there was a book here, because Chris was a very, very slippery guy in a way that he didn't say a lot. He didn't make his intentions really clear all the time to everybody. And he wasn't interviewed a lot. So I thought, God, I don't know if I can really do this. It's interesting. Right. But eventually it was kind of like the way I describe it, it was kind of like I had a bunch of broken pieces of glass or something, different mm-hmm. colors. And all of a sudden the mosaic started to kind of show up. You know, you put this right. piece here, put this piece here, and all of a sudden you're going, wait a minute, there's an actual story here. And it turned out to be much, much more in depth than I ever thought it was going to be. And I was very pleased. I just have to say, sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, but I was pleased the way it turned out.
No, it's a fantastic book. And again, it's my business these days to read all these books. And when I saw it, and I did see that this book had been published a while ago, you know, I was just, wow, how did I not hear about this, and so on and so forth. But let's get into Chris, and let's actually start with Chris's birth and childhood, sure. The impact of growing up in the Black country, the wonderful house that the family kind of lived in. I believe it's Congreve Hall. And actually the role kind of nature, you know, played early on. You know, he was into birds, and it's obviously reflected in the way he decided to go musically. So let's hear about a little bit about his childhood.
Yeah, well, he grew up, like you said, in this area called the Black Country. It's Birmingham, England, basically. Starbridge was the kind of suburb of Birmingham where he grew up. His dad, you know, worked for, I think, like the county. And he was kind of like an engineer and sort of organized, you know, developments and things like that. They gave him this place to live. They didn't own the house, but they gave him kind of a residence. And it was this place called Congreve Hall. And it was just kind of an extraordinary place. It was, to me, it looked like a castle. I've actually been there, and I went there with Stephanie. Yeah, when I went there, it's been recently turned into an apartment building, and it looks real clean and neat and stuff. But when I went there, it was closed. It was boarded up.
Yeah.
And, but you got the sense of the atmosphere. So he grew up in a very atmospheric house, but the area around him was, there was a lot of poverty.
Right. Mining.
You know, it was the mining and the industrial sort of what was left of the Industrial Revolution, kind of broken down factories and abandoned buildings and stuff. So he was able to kind of like explore that area. And like you said, right around the house, there was woods and trees. And so I think with the birds coming in, he was getting that part of it, and he was loving that and painting pictures of the woods around him. And then he was also going out into the industrial area. So it was kind of like this yin yang thing. Environmentally, I think, for him. And I think they both soaked in to his kind of psyche.
And then a lot of his, like you say, a lot of his early interest in music came from his father's love. His real love was jazz, right? And you
that's
mentioned
right.
about, you know, his father and Brahms. You know, you could hear that reflected in his playing. And something about the, I guess it was Les Span, the C flute, which is...
Yes, right, right.
And Chico Hamilton. So tell us a little about his interest in jazz and how he actually did have an art school education, and he was a very talented visual artist, which he did not pursue ultimately.
That's right. I think, you know, a lot of it comes down to, like you said, his father, and his father had classical and some jazz to expose him to. But Chris really ran with that. He really, really loved it. And, you know, he was friends with people who would say, like, nobody knew anything about jazz around here except Chris. So he would go to the record stores in Birmingham and come back with stuff that nobody else had kind of heard. And he was very sophisticated. I mean, like I said, his friends that I talked to, some of them were kind of shocked, you know, in the sense of what he was bringing back to them, because there was none of that in that particular environment. So jazz was really his thing. And the reason and the thread that kind of goes through his whole life, I think, from that point on, was that he knew about kind of commercial music, stuff that was made for, you know, selling, you know, basically what he called pop music.
Right.
And he wasn't interested in that at all, because I think he saw through it. And I think he sort of said, you know, this is a product for money and promotion, and that's not what music is supposed to be. There's a really cool, I don't know, I mentioned it in the book, but he was interviewed by a newspaper when he started his first jazz group.
The Birmingham yeah. news article, yeah.
And he made it really clear, and it was like something, what I realized later was that was a thread that started there. It went through the rest of his career and the rest of his life, which was basically, you know, pop music is garbage and you need to come from a place within yourself.
Right.
And it's coming out of you. It's got to have emotion. He used that term mood music. It's got to have something to do with the way you're feeling at the time. And right. that's what music's about.
Well, and that was really the thread that bound him and Winwood, was really the love of jazz. And that was sort of the yin yang in the group traffic too. There was a, you know, Chris reflecting the sort of jazz extemporaneous side. And then there was the side early with Dave Mason and yeah. also with Winwood to some degree.
Yeah.
Where it was pulling towards pop. Tell us about his first band was, you know, jazz was his initial love and first bands. And then there was an interesting connection that I had no idea about, which was his connection with Christine Perfect, became Christine McVie. So if you could, and that was regarding around the art school, his art school time. So if you give us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, that music explosion was going on there, you know, it was getting into the R&B stuff. You know, it was kind of in the early 60s, it was evolving out of this kind of weird trad jazz thing that really was just, again, kind of a pop version of jazz. But then the kind of R&B thing started to take off. And when he got to art school, he was just playing with a lot of different people. He was kind of, you know, like the way I described him, he was kind of an itinerant musician. He would just drop in here, drop in there, and he was just experiencing things. And they were starting this band, this guy named David Yates, or his nickname was Rowdy. And he was just enamored with, you know, creating kind of like a happening group. And so he's trying to put this group together. And Christine Perfect was somebody that Chris knew from art school, and he had played with her. And so he brought her into that group. And so you've got, you know, a pretty eclectic mix of people already coming into his life and playing music with him. And I wish that there was something I could report back about what they sounded like exactly, but there's like right. zero, you know, they never did a demo. They were never on TV. You know, there's really right. no pictures of them as a group. So they were together for quite a while, and Chris kind of like used it to build his chops, I think. And I don't think he was ever totally devoted to that group, The Sounds of Blue, but that was one of the places he was transitioning from jazz into the more popular music a little bit
right.
from there.
And and a huge part of his life and the book is kind of his connection to the paranormal, spiritualism, ghosts, and specifically things that I had known before is his sort of traveling the Lee Lines of Britain, which connected all these sites. So if you could go a little bit into that, and then the significance of this place called Whitley Court in his life and his studies in this area.
Yeah, Chris was, I mean, the more I got to discover about him, the more I really liked him, because he just seemed like if you could hang out with somebody cool, that would have been the guy to hang out with, you know, because his interest kind of went all over the place. And the paranormal stuff, I think, started when he was young, partly maybe to do with Whitley Court itself, and who knows what other reasons, but he tied music and particularly the flute in with this right. idea of this kind of ghostliness and ghostly sounds and things like that. So he was able to kind of bridge his different interests by using music and then these ideas about the paranormal. So it's a long kind of complicated thing as far as like what did he learn and what did he try to incorporate there. But he did, like you said, he understood this idea of like ley lines, these power lines that went across the world. And if you were on one of those things, you were able to get some of the Earth's energy, and he believed in that totally. And ghosts, he really tried to understand ghosts. He went to haunt any place that someone said was haunted, he would try to go to.
Right.
So, and his friends, he would just drag them along, you know, and
well, you say, people. Yeah, you say, you know, again, we're going to go into him meeting Steve Winwood in 62, mm-hmm. but he would bring people there. One of them was a then 16-year-old Steve Winwood. And then you have a yeah. pretty humorous story in there about whether he brought Dylan, but Dylan also went there when the traffic folks yeah. were out at Whitley Court.
Yeah. So Whitley Court was just, and I've been to Whitley Court. It's just an incredible place because it was built, I'm forgetting the date, but it was built in the 1800s, I think. And it was just one of those places it was built for a coal baron, you know, right. who had so much money and could do anything that he wanted to. And then it got handed down a few times. And then somewhere, I think it was in the 1930s, it caught fire and, the building just kind of, most of it collapsed right. and they couldn't afford to fix it. So they, I think, just abandoned it. Hmm. And it was just kind of sitting there in the countryside. And I don't know how Chris found out about it. No one ever really told me that. But as far as I can tell of his friend group, he was the first one to know anything about that. And he would investigate it. He would go room to room. He would go at nighttime. There was a church next door and it would be playing this ghostly sort of sounding organ music and stuff. And so he would bring his friends. And before you know it, everybody was in town, heard about it and was coming out there. So he did bring Steve. Bob Dylan definitely was there. I've read Bob's quotes about it and he was fascinated by it too. The funny thing about it is, which I think is what you're getting to, is that while Chris did all this stuff, in the end, the story about Bob Dylan coming out to Whitley Court, everybody tried to write Chris out of the whole story right, for right. some reason.
Yeah.
Jim Capaldi did. He just kind of said, well, you know, Dave wasn't there and Chris wasn't there. It was just me and Steve.
Yeah.
So Jim had this tight thing where he wanted to keep with Winwood, you know, as kind of like a special relationship, and maybe right. that
everybody was fighting over him. So again, yeah. what we were saying, the real heart and soul of Traffic, you know, to some degree was their connection, especially the more exploratory side. Winwood yeah. and Chris met in 1962, and tell us the story of how from their initial meeting and their various jam sessions at this famous place called the Elbow Room, how that whole group came together and kind of was wrestled at, should we say, out of the his time. He was sequestered away from Spencer Davis at the height of their fame.
Yes. You know, there's some controversy, I guess, about when Steve actually met Chris. Stephanie Wood thinks that she introduced Steve and Chris, that she knew Steve before Chris did. And that would have been about 1965 when the Spencer Davis group was starting to get big. And right. Stephanie was a clothing designer. And so she was making clothes for some of these rock stars and stuff.
Yes, like all that. The hip clothes.
Yeah. So she was able to do that. But the funny thing was that the other Steve that was important to Chris was Steve Hadley. And he's the one that started this quartet back in 62 with Steve, and that started off in his early art school days, or with Chris, I mean, it started off in his early art school days. And I talked to Steve Hadley, and he was very clear about it. He said, no, there was little club called the Chapel, and people used to hang out there. And Steve was coming in there with his brother. This was before Spencer Davis.
Right.
And that's when they met, and that they talked to each other and they played music together and stuff like that. So there was some kind of relationship happening way earlier than anybody thought. And how they developed that relationship, you know, it's not 100% clear, but there was obviously some contact all the while that Steve was in Spencer Davis. But then I think what was happening was that Steve was looking at Spencer Davis, and then he was looking kind of like what Chris was interested in. And eventually he's going, well, this is just much more interesting. And, you know, so he started to hang out with Chris, like you said, at this place called the Elbow Room that was a jazz club. And it was kind of an exclusive place in Birmingham, and really only the cool people got to kind of go there. But it was supposed to be a really incredible place, and a very like a crucible for musicians to get together and not just play, but to jam. And so Steve was doing that when he'd get off of Spencer Davis, and Chris would be able to be there, and they would start jamming. And then it was hanging out with Jim Capaldi and his band called The Deep Feeling.
Right.
And that was a really cool group. If you ever, never, have you heard any of the music of Deep Feeling?
I actually haven't heard the music. I should, since we're done, I will.
It's almost like proto Traffic. It's got Polly Palmer, who was later in Family. He played flute and he also played drums. And so it sounded a little bit like Traffic. And so, Jim was already in kind of a hip phase, as far as he'd claimed that he took LSD before anybody else. And he was well into the psychedelic stuff. And so my point is that Jim and his band Deep Feeling would be playing at the Elbow Room, and Steve and Chris would come in, and they would kind of get together, and that became this kind of mixing of those two groups. Now Dave Mason wasn't actually there, right? Well, let me put it this way:
the roadie, Dave, right?
Dave was a roadie for Spencer Davis, right? Which is really, really strange, and that always seemed weird to me that he would do that, but. As you read in the book, I think he was being very strategic
totally.
By hanging out with Steve, he's going, well, that's a good thing, you know, and I'm a roadie today, but I'm also a guitar player.
Right.
So he kind of, I think, played his cards very carefully with Steve. And so it would be Steve and Chris coming into the Elbow Room. Jim would be there. And then Dave started showing up as well. And then when they would get back together on stage, because, Dave had already played with Jim before, and he was in the previous band.
Wasn't it Hellions. Sort of a Ginger and Jack situation that he was fired? He fired him, right?
I think you're right about that, because, you know, you even read stuff later where Jim talks about Dave, and he would just be shaking his head. You know, he's like, yeah, he was something else, that guy, you know, but they could never get too far from each other either. You know, they ended up touring together. You probably know that. Probably, yeah. Let's see, it was 1998 and 1999. Jim and Dave were back together, you know, playing music. So,
So finally,
anyways, it fell together in the Elbow Room. That is true, and I think that's for most people that talk about Traffic, that's where the story starts. They always say it's the Elbow Room, and the only thing I tried to do is to say, well, okay, that's cool, but Steve and Chris. We're doing stuff way before that and not getting really any credit for that as far as in the chronology of the whole thing. So then the
whole thing, obviously, at the time Steve decides to go off, you know, Spencer Davis has two real big hits. So the record company is like, well, this kid is the show. Let's support him. So what they do is they got their act together. They got it together in the country, as they say. I should tell you right now, I don't know if I'd mentioned this to you, I'm literally a half a mile from Big Pink. That's where I live.
That's awesome.
So which actually, according to you and this book, was sort of the second getting it together in the country, timing wise. They were put up in this famous cottage out in Aster Tirol, I believe, and they moved in April 1967, April Fool's Day, according to you, and that's where it all began. Endless jamming, endless superstars visiting. So tell us a little bit about that whole scene. Obviously, Drugs were an important part of their creative process. A lot of hashish, it sounds like, and other substances. So let's talk about that. And I hadn't realized until I read your book that they actually did recording there. I just thought it was they lived there and rehearsed. But with that big introduction, let's talk about the cottage.
Well, I guess the first thing I would point out is that this whole thing of like Steve leaving Spencer Davis, it was, from a commercial music point of view, it was a crazy thing to do. It really was crazy because he, they were hitting the big time and they were just getting ready to go to the United States. And if they'd done that, they would have been on a different league altogether, the Spencer
Right.
Davis Group, because Gimme Some Lovin' and I'm a Man, they were huge, huge hits. So you have to kind of think how extraordinary it was for Steve Winwood to say, okay, that's happening. That kind of success is going on, but I don't care. I want to do this other thing. And again, I don't want to push everything onto Chris, but I will say that that was his point of view was like, you can have all the success in the world, but if you don't have the integrity of the art, you don't have anything. And I really think that that's what he inculcated into Steve's mind was that that was the thing. Because if you read the press that he's giving around that time, early 67, he's just shitting all over pop music. He's going, it's
Right.
garbage. It's, he literally is not, he's saying it doesn't matter to me. So by them getting to this house in the countryside there, outside of Aston Trold, they were able to kind of like bring together, these personalities and then not let it diffuse anywhere because they were living together and they were able to kind of like just face each other and work. And it did, I think drugs were heavily involved, but it was drugs related to making music. And I think the whole thing was like a crucible almost, an incubator for that music.
And that's
So
where the first album comes out of well, the first album comes out of that experience. The songs were written there,
yes.
and that comes out, and immediately the band sort of has issues. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think the whole idea was with Traffic, I think they were going to be one of these groups that was going to meld their personalities into one thing. I think that was the intention. And I know that the early intentions of writing music was that it was going to be done as a collective and that everybody's name was going to be on everything. So,
Right.
it was going to be the four of them
Like the
and
Doors.
like the Doors, right? And groups like REM later,
Right.
And it's a good thing to do because it brings in this cohesion that says, it doesn't matter who has the first idea. We're all working together. We're all contributing. It's our project. This is our product, and it's all for one for all. And the problem was, as far as I can tell, is that Dave Mason just was not interested in doing that. He was writing his songs. He was writing them separately from the group. And when he would come back, they'd say, well, let's, do this and let's do this. And he'd say, no, this is my song. We're going to do it this way. It's going to be a Dave Mason song. You're the group that's playing it. And so I think he sort of split them up almost immediately,
Yeah.
almost,
Well,
almost the first few months.
and speaking of shrewdness, so the first hit was Paper Sun, and then there was going to be which did very well, and then the second tune was supposed to be Colored Rain, was supposed to be the A side, but it ended up being Hole in My Shoe, which was a Dave Mason song. And that was a very interesting fact, is that there's a spoken word part in it with a little girl, and that Dave secured the record company president's daughter to do the, I mean, that's pretty, I, and again, I, having talked to Dave recently, he's a pretty shrewd guy. Like, he didn't want to give away many of the story. He was kind of a diff, not diff, he's a great guy, not difficult. Just, he didn't want to give away the stories that were in his book. So I'll let you give them away. So that ended up, but that was a very successful album, Mr. Fantasy. And then Dave departs right on the heels of their first tour, correct?
They were, again, it's going to America. That's the place you want to go. You know, they get the tour plotted out. They're getting ready to go. And then, you know, Dave was disenchanted. I'm, you know, he wrote a, I have not read his biography yet, but, you know, I was assuming he wrote about that. And he, but what he told me was he just said, you know, I don't know. He just, it wasn't what I wanted. I didn't want fame. I just wanted something else. And he was pretty vague about it, you know, but he was doing other work. He was, you know, jumping around, you know, with other groups and Hendrix and producing music for the group
Right.
Family and stuff like that. So he was interested in the music
Really?
business,
Yeah,
but
he.
I don't know, you know, it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell what he thought or what he wanted, but he did. And, you know, Steve's girlfriend at the time, Penny, she basically said he left us in the lurch. You know,
Yeah.
he was supposed to be there and go, and then he just said, no, I'm not doing it.
Which then actually showcased, you know, as much as Chris is known for his flute playing and his sax playing, he played a lot of, he played organ on the stage, he played bass. And actually, to jump to one of the things that has, we've touched on it briefly, but which really went through his life is that he did not really get the proper credit, writing credit for his contributions. And that really began with Mr. Fantasy, according to your book. He kind of was the one who came around with the, I guess, the bass line for the song.
Well, he did get credit for that song.
Oh, he
That,
did. Oh,
yeah,
he did.
that was a you know, Capaldi Winwood Wood
Oh, okay. I'm
composition.
sorry.
And
No,
there
I
were
didn't.
several on that first album that he did get credit, like Colored Rain, he also got credit for that. And
Oh, okay.
I'm not remembering, but the,
Well,
I think he,
the big one jumping further ahead was Barleycorn.
true, right.
Which was the which I guess was the royalty cash cow in a way, one of them.
Yeah. That's right. And it's tricky, you know, because you know, I don't know, you know, I wasn't there, but you know, Steve probably arranged it pretty tightly towards what he wanted for Mr. or for John Barleycorn. But I know that Jim was very adamant about the fact that he thought Chris deserved credit for that. I mean, I have it on tape when I talked to
Right.
him. You know, he was actually angry about it. And he said, you
Yeah.
know, Chris really, really deserved credit for that. And Chris was really, really angry about that too.
Well,
Even
the
years later, he would
yeah.
be very, very pissed off about it. But,
Well,
you know, things.
the story is he discovered the song, the original, one of the original, well, it's a very old song, but one of the original versions, an a cappella version by the Watersons, and brought it into the band, and he was into folk music at that time, and then they just kind of went, and he obviously his flute is a huge contribution to the song. So, you know, that was unfortunate. So going on with Traffic, then he the second album comes around. They're short on songs. Dave is back. And Chris makes some amazing contributions to that album on the tunes. I believe it's Crying to Be Heard, and obviously 40,000 Headmen. And he actually was he was inspired a lot. He actually innovated the sax, copying something or get taking something from Eddie Harris. He was he electrified the sax. He started using wah-wah on the saxophone. So tell us a little bit about, you know, Chris's approach to both instruments and how it's so unique.
Yeah, you're right. Eddie Harris, I think, was a big influence on him because Eddie Harris, you know, he did electrify the sax and he was doing a kind of effects with it and stuff like that. And Chris had heard that, and he wanted. You know, I think, and Jim Capaldi said this a lot too, is that Chris didn't look at the saxophone like as a straight instrument. He looked at it as a as an artistic expression of what he was thinking and feeling. And so the more he could modify it, the more he seemed to be happy, you know, in the sense that putting a wah-wah pedal, for example,
Right.
with the thing. And then there were various types of amplification systems, and he ended up with this thing called the Maestro,
Right.
which was really gave him a lot of control because it came with a control panel and he could do, you know, what he wanted to with the sound and stuff like that. So yeah, he was, you know, he was willing to take convention and throw it out, you know, and just say, well, I want it to sound like this. And when you listen to that John Barleycorn album, it's really got a lot of really cool sounds on it, totally. As far as the saxophone goes.
Yeah.
You know, you listen to something like Glad and Freedom Rider, and it's he's really doing some interesting stuff there. So he was willing to basically try anything. The downside of it, I think, was that I think Chris got really frustrated with the technology. And I know that he on stage, he would constantly be having problems like getting it to sound right. And he'd be frustrated a lot with it. And sometimes it wouldn't work right. And when that would really create problems for him. So I think it was kind of like a double-edged sword. If you got a simple instrument, it's very reliable, but his system wasn't always that reliable.
Yeah. And so Traffic ultimately breaks up for the first time after the second album and a couple of tracks. Jim, Chris, and Dave do another band, which lasts 60 days. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah, they were called Mason Capaldi Wood and Frog, or that was their original moniker, you know. It was just a thing where Steve left, at the end of 1968. So he, you know, my theory was that he and Clapton had already kind of got something going. Mm-hmm. And because it kind of didn't make sense otherwise, because Traffic was working on another album and things seemed to be going pretty well.
Right.
Dave was already out, but there was the three of them and they seemed to be doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly Steve left. And so basically it was, you know, left down to Chris. I mean, Chris was basically, I think, distraught, and so was Jim. They didn't know what to do with themselves. And then you got Chris Blackwell, who basically is the manager, and he said, right. Well, you know, you guys can actually make another group here if you want. And he suggested Dave Mason. So they called him. He came over. He was in the United States. I think he was in L.A. Mm-hmm. He came back. They needed a keyboard player and, you know, Steve Winwood's one level of keyboard and then you have kind of everybody else.
Yeah.
And so they got, what was the guy's? Oh, Mick Weaver was right. The name. Yeah. And he was already kind of famous, Winder K. Frog. He was somebody a lot of people knew, very, very good. But they just kind of put a band together and they just decided that this was going to be what they did. And they practiced, you know, they went out, got a place in the country, tried to kind of get it together the way Traffic had and stuff like that. But it was just kind of like this nebulous thing. And they did play gigs and they played the BBC and there's some recordings of them available. They were going to make an album, but they never did. But apparently the vibe just wasn't that great. You know, they really had this strong desire to get back on the horse, you know, and keep doing something. But I think this put together group thing just, you know, wasn't quite right. And I think Dave got disenchanted with it. If I was to kind of surmise, I think he just kind of finally looked at it and said, well, this isn't suiting my needs or something to that extent. And he just left them basically.
So from there, you know, he did other, you know, he became involved in other recordings around this time, a little before, a little after, with Free, recorded with Hendrix, of course, in New York.
And then the Rolling Stones.
Rolling Stones, right. Memo from Turner, right? That, which was not released, correct?
Yeah, it actually wasn't Memo from Turner. He, let's see, what did he do? That was with the Stones, he worked on Street Fighting Man, was. Okay. Yeah, Memo from Turner was a tune that Steve and Jim claimed to have done by themselves. Chris might have been involved, but it wasn't audible if he was. But
he was then involved with the woman who was the love of his life, Jeanette Jacobs.
Yes.
In the first album and actually the live show and first album of Ginger Baker's Air Force until Ginger got a little pissed at him for being drunk at a rehearsal or something and hit him in the head with a stick. That sounds very Ginger. So
So the chronology of that kind of was that, so this Mason Capaldi wooden frog, they just didn't last that long, and then everybody just kind of scattered to the winds, and Chris ended up with Dr. John.
right.
So he went to America because Blind Faith had gone to America, and I think, I'm not sure what Chris's idea was, but he was in Madison Square Garden when they did their first,
Right.
American gig and stuff, and I guess he was there to hang out or something, but he ended up, he'd known Jeanette Jacobs a little bit before that, I think, and
Familiar.
then they got together with Dr. John, who had come into town, and basically it was just an ad hoc thing. There's Dr. John, they needed some people, they needed singers, so they got Jeanette Jacobs involved, and Chris was there and pulled out his saxophone, and apparently it was this very, very organic thing that they were able to kind of put together and have that group take place. And so that happened during the summer of 69. And then when he came back from the United States, that's when the whole Air Force thing kind of took
Right.
off. And that was, I don't think that was ever going to be a thing for too long. Steve was already planning, I think, his solo album and stuff like that. So he was getting ready to do, his solo debut in 1970 and or 69, and Air
Which
Force
be,
was just kind of an
yeah,
intermediate step.
which became Barleycorn, and then they would go
Yes.
on from there. To I think their most successful US album, which is Low Spark, which definitely has a big Chris influence in terms of
Yes.
the lengthy, especially the title track, 13 minutes of and that really was as great as it was, it sort of, like Dr. John, it introduced an element of folks who were involved with narcotics. In that band, Jim Gordon, there's a recently great book by Joel Selvin, which I had talked to Joel about, Rick Gretsch and Rebop, so, and also with Jeanette. So the substances became an issue for him, alcohol, drugs, and he did have a bit of stage fright, he said, is part of the reason this all developed for him.
I if you go back, Chris, I think, had a propensity to substance abuse probably from the time he was a kid.
Right.
He was a drinker and a heavy drinker at times, when sometimes his friends, I mean, early on, would say, slow down, man, and he would just keep going for it. So I think he was insecure, and unsure of himself in some ways, and he needed sort of a boost of confidence, with drugs and stuff. But you're right, once he got to Low Spark, and that whole era of rock, it was before everybody was smoking pot a little bit and LSD, which, big
Right.
fucking deal, but now they're into coke and heroin and stuff like that. And that seemed to happen through that whole era, where suddenly people were getting mowed down, like swaths of them falling. And it was just, I think that was the heaviness of that time, was these addictive drugs coming into the scene and stuff. And Chris just got involved in that, just like other people did. And I think he had a really, really tough time kind of getting himself back out of it. Some
Well,
people
that
did and
band,
some people
yeah.
didn't.
After that band, they get a sort of a more stable crew in with the Muscle Shoals guys, and Chris is again actually contributing composition. He contributed "Tragic Magic," which is the title of your book, to was that Los that wasn't was Fantasy Factory?
Yeah, that's right. He, I think what was happening there, I mean, in the sort of bigger picture, was that Steve and Jim had kind of created this kind of like a Jagger Richards or a Lennon McCartney. They just decided that was the songwriting team, for the band. And I think that was really, really bad for Chris. I think Chris always wanted it to be a co-op. He always wanted it to be a shared situation where everybody's creativity was equally expressed. He just wasn't able to get that. And I think it was hard for him, from all indications I got, it was hard for him to just say, okay, I'm going to write a song and it's going to be my song and my identity. I think he saw his identity as part of a Traffic identity. So I don't think it was easy for him to do that, but he did do it. He was able to kind of pull together this really cool jazzy number and stuff like that. And the Muscle Shoals guys were great, because they were able to kind of translate musically this stuff really efficiently and to do it in a high quality way.
Right. So and she they didn't, they weren't, they weren't enablers also.
They were very straight guys. They drank a little bit and stuff like that, but they're really straight arrows and business people too, because they had a studio and that was their business. And so they looked at it in a totally different way, which was good for Chris. It was good for Traffic. I think Traffic would have broken up if it hadn't been for them. That'd be my guess, because it was just too fragmented, but they were able to get it back on track and get really good tours across the United States and across Europe and, you know, keep the band rolling for quite a while.
Well, the final album with Chris was was When the Eagle Flies, where the Muscle Shoals guys were out. Jim was back on drums. They brought in Roscoe G. And there were two tracks that supposedly might have been on that album that kind of became the centerpieces of the solo work that ultimately came out after Chris's life, which is Moonchild Vulcan. And barbed wire. So Moonchild was really a set piece of their live shows for a while, right?
That's right. And they, you know, Traffic did a really, really cool thing in early 74. What they did was they didn't have a new album out, but they toured with a new album. They basically played every single song that was going to be on the next album for a whole tour across Europe. And they just said, basically, you're saying to people, this is us. Hope you like it. You know, this is what we're going to do. And it went over really, really well. And so that song, Moonchild Vulcan, was played every single night. And it was, you know, a Chris vehicle. You know, it was jazzy. You know, it had the nice section for a guitar and horn solo. And it was a cool tune, you know. So
And it was cut for sort of a tune that they thought was not so great.
I mean, so when they finally got to putting the album together, that song was supposed to be on the album, and it was kind of like Shoot Out of the Fantasy Factory had a Chris Wood song on it. This one was supposed to have a Chris Wood song on it, and I think, like I said in the book, it was kind of for his dignity too. You know, it's like I'm a part of this band, you know, and if I can't be shared in the songwriting, I want to at least have my song. So he had this good song and they played it and they recorded it. And then when it got time to put the album together, he said, well, it's a little long.
Right.
And so they put in this song called Memories of a Rock and Roller.
Right.
Rock and Roller.
Pretty good song.
Which is a cool little tune. Yeah.
And on that, I think you said there was sort of a cautionary tune that Walking in the Wind was a tune that Capaldi lyrically wrote. It was sort of a cautionary tale of Chris and Jeanette to some degree, right?
Classic it was, music. Yeah. And that was something that I would not have known except that Jim actually told it to me. He said that, you know, when he was writing this song, Walking in the Wind, it was really about Jeanette and it was about Chris. And if you put that in mind and then listen to the song, then you can hear them because it's about Plastic Princess, which was Jeanette, and then a guy who was having snowballs hurtling through his mind, you know, and that was Chris. And so they were in there, and that's a great song, you know. And but when you think about it, Chris had to play that song every night, knowing that it was about him.
It's kind of a Fleetwood Mac situation, right? You know, like
I guess so.
So ultimately, the band, you know, that Traffic is done, and then. He just, for the, I guess, the remaining 8 to 10 years of his life, you know, he's trying to record. He goes to Brazil for a while, which is where Cat Stevens was and Dudley Moore, you mentioned. So he really struggles to kind of get an album together over that course of time. He invests in a recording studio also. And so tell us about, you know, the sort of the final creative chapter and of his life and kind of how after his passing it finally came out.
Okay. Well, Chris just suffered a lot of losses basically, and the loss of Traffic was, you know, it's kind of like cutting off a leg or something like that. You know, it was just, it was a really, really, really tough thing for him to overcome. And I think he really, really wanted it to get back together. he wanted to get back with Steve, and he tried a lot, you know, and there were times where they were able to get together a little bit and jam and stuff like that. And some of that went pretty well. But he also lost his wife, Jeanette. You know, he was
Right.
very much in love with her. And one day he came home and she was just gone, you know.
Right.
So he was trying to put together music with a drug and alcohol problem, with a loss of self-esteem, loss of, you know, his creative partners. Then he loses his wife. So it was really, he was like a guy. I mean, the more I researched it, and you must have gotten this from reading the book, you just feel empathy for the guy.
Yeah,
Because
totally.
the one thing I can tell you about Chris Wood was he was a decent human being.
Right.
And he was in a situation where he tried to do things in a straight and fair way, and he had his own problems. But eventually people just looked at him and said, "Nah, you're too much trouble for me." And sort of it just kind of kept cascading that way. So it got harder and harder for him to kind of create for all those reasons. And yet he still did. He would produce some music and it was good. You know, it was interesting. It was
Yeah.
jazzy. It was complicated.
Sort of jazz, like jazz fusion before
Yes.
jazz fusion in some kind of weird way, or it really was jazz fusion.
And you got to give him credit because he didn't try to sound like Traffic. He had
No.
his own thing and his vision was there and it was starting to kind of emerge. But it was just kind of like a race between that and his body, you know, failing. And it
And
just kind of ran out, I think, is what ended up
he
happening.
succumbed in 83. He was 39 years old.
He just turned 39.
And then let's talk about, sort of like, I guess to some degree, like Syd Barrett. His sister played an important role in his legacy, obviously working with you and granting you sort of access to put together this book. And then you were also involved. So the Vulcan album actually finally came out. The initial release was in 2008, and then there was a very limited edition box set. If you could tell us a little bit about those two things.
Sure. Yeah, in 2008, what happened there was I think I was the one that was contacted because I guess I was out there on the internet of being some kind of an expert on Chris Wood, but Cherry Red, you know, Cherry Red Records,
Sure,
and
yeah. My
they have
buddy
an
Jan
imprint,
Ackerman works with them.
right? They have an imprint, something called Esoteric Discs or whatever. So they got in touch with me and just said, "Look, we know that there's some songs out there for Chris Wood. Do you think this could happen?" And so I kind of put it together with Stephanie and basically said these guys are interested, and they started looking for tapes and stuff like that. And they, long story, but they were able to find, you know,
Amazing.
basically a fair amount of what they thought would be on the album. So that came out, like you said, in 2008. And I was involved in the writing the notes and actually the cover design and stuff like that for
Yeah, it's
that. And
great.
I think it came out pretty good. But then, so what happened after that was this guy named Neil Story wanted to really do a comprehensive sort of box set of Chris's stuff. And he worked with Stephanie and he worked with me and his wife Jane, and they developed this thing called Evening Blue, which was this big, huge retrospective box with lots of pictures and lots of tracks with different people where Chris would be playing as a session, some of his own stuff, some stuff with Traffic. There wasn't any unreleased Traffic or very little, but it was mostly his unreleased music or tracks, and then tracks he did with other people.
Right.
And that came out, I don't remember what year that was, but
But there's a bunch of that stuff is, I think, on Spotify, some of it. I don't know if it's
sure.
all,
Yeah, I would think
yeah.
so.
So it's all fantastic stuff. He had a very unique style. As we say, as Capaldi said, he wasn't really out to sound like a sax player, and in a lot of ways he didn't. And his flute playing is kind of extraordinarily human on one element, and also otherworldly on another. Again, the book is Tragic Magic, The Life of Traffic's Chris Wood. Thank you, Dan Ropeck, and
Thanks, Sal.
look forward to reading it again.
Okay, awesome. Appreciate your interest. Thanks a lot.